Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very pleased to have Sam Kassow on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Who Will Write Our History? Emanuel Ringelblum, The Warsaw Ghetto, and the Oinig Shabbos Archive. A lot has been written about the Holocaust, obviously, and unfortunately much of it, or even most of it, has been written from the perspective of the perpetrators, that is, the Germans. The reason for this is quite simple, and that is that the Germans took very meticulous notes about what they were doing. They were great record keepers. So much of what we know about the horrendous crime that they committed at mid-century comes from German archives. Now, what makes this book particularly interesting to us is that here we see the Holocaust, and particularly the Warsaw Ghetto, from the point of view of Jews themselves, and from a very particular perspective, that is, from the perspective of a group of left-wing Zionists led by Emanuel Ringelblum, a quite heroic figure, who decided that after the Germans had taken Warsaw, that they needed to chronicle Jewish life in the ghetto. It in ways, is a tragic story, and it is a story of bravery, it is a story of honor, it is a story of betrayal, but most of all, it's a story of people who are extraordinarily committed to the historical project, even as they face their imminent deaths. The members of the Oinig Shabbos Archive in 1941, 42, 43 continued to write the history of what was a vanishing Jewish people. We should thank Sam for writing this book. And without further ado, here is the interview. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Marshall. How are you doing?
I'm very well today. It's very cold here in Iowa. How are you? Where are you right now?
I'm in West Hartford, Connecticut, and everything's covered in ice.
Ice? Yeah, no, we have snow here. That's what happens during the winter. Anyway, I should tell our listeners that we have Sam Kassow on the show today, and we'll be talking about his new book, Who Will Write Our History? Emanuel Ringelblum, The Warsaw Ghetto, and the Oinig Shabbos Archive. Sam, am I pronouncing that correctly?
The Oinig Shabbos Archive.
Shabbos Archive. I had the accent wrong. I'll probably make that mistake again. I've read the book, and it is just a remarkable story. It is one of the most, I mean, if you're subject to historians, it's the most poignant story about historians I have absolutely ever read. And at moments it's very triumphant, and at other moments it's incredibly tragic. And you have to admire the bravery of everyone involved. I was extraordinarily impressed. And as a scholarly work, it's truly amazing, because Sam works in all the languages and has read all the sources, and It's just a privilege to read a book like this. So Sam, I've laid my cards on the table here. You know what I think. So maybe I could begin by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, where you went to school, and how you became interested in history and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I was born in Germany in a displaced persons camp after World War II. My parents were Holocaust survivors. I grew up in Connecticut. I really got interested in history when I was an undergraduate at Trinity College, where I'm teaching now.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, and then I got a fellowship to go to England, and I studied with a great professor, Leonard Shapiro, at Lund School of Economics. And my interest in Russian history deepened, and I went to Princeton for a doctorate, and I became a Russian historian. And for many years, I really had nothing to do with the Holocaust, or I found it very difficult to approach in a scholarly manner, maybe because I felt too close to the material. Mm-hmm. After my parents passed away, I realized that it was very important to tell the story. And I got very interested in a Jewish historian, Emanuel Ringelblum, who perished in the Holocaust, who was shot in 1944. And I began to ask myself, how did this historian gather 60 people in the Warsaw Ghetto and organize this incredible archive project, which left thousands and thousands of documents? At the same time, he was able to keep absolute secrecy. In fact, the project was so secret that it was almost lost forever, because of the 60 people in the project, there were only 3 survivors. Only one knew where the archive had been hidden. After the war, Warsaw was such rubble that even if you knew where a building had been, it was hard to find it.
Mm-hmm.
And this story of how a historian in the middle of absolute chaos and catastrophe is able to remain true to his mission to record history.
Yeah, that is truly, I think, the most remarkable part of the story. I mean, because you hear a lot of historians in the United States kvetching about the conditions under which we work. But it is nothing compared to the conditions under which these people worked. And the degree to which they maintained their principles toward things like objectivity and using primary sources and gathering and creating archives is truly a testament to the way that they were, I guess, trained. So why don't we begin by talking a little bit about that. Tell us about Ringelblum and his circle.
Emanuel Ringelblum was a member of the Polish Jewish intelligentsia before the war. He was a historian. He was a community organizer. He was very much involved in a radical political party, the Left Labor Zionists. Jewish historians in Poland in the 20s and 30s did not have any chance at a regular academic job, but nevertheless, they kept in touch. They had seminars. They read each other papers. They saw history long before World War II as a weapon of national defense against mm-hmm. anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. If anti-Semitic historians in Poland were saying, we're using scholarship to argue that Jews were aliens, that Jews were newcomers, that Jews had damaged Poland, that Jews had been responsible for Poland's collapse in the 18th century, then historians like Emanuel Ringelblum, Rafael Mahler, Isaac Shipper used their own scholarship to say that the Jews had helped build the country, they'd been in the country for centuries, that they were an integral part of the nation. So this idea that history was not only scholarship, but it was also national defense, it was part of nation building, this idea was highly developed before the war. When the war starts, at first, of course, they had very little idea that the Germans are going to kill everybody. The Nazis themselves didn't know that until late 1941. Mm-hmm. But when the war starts, Ringelblum is determined to document every aspect of Jewish existence, mainly in order
to create a usable past for the post-war period, that the Jewish community would emerge from the war. They would look at the record, what worked, what didn't work, what leaders succeeded, what leaders failed, and that this would help the Jewish community gain a better sense of itself. This was the original focus, and then, of course, as the war went on and as German intentions became clearer, the agendas changed.
Yeah. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the various divisions within the Jewish intelligentsia itself in the interwar period, because we need to, and this is one of the things I learned from the book, we need to situate Ringelblum and his circle in relation to other groups. Now, he was, I don't know if this is the right word, but he was a Yiddishist?
Yes. Polish Jewry before the war was very divided. It was a community of about 3.5 million people. They were divided about religion versus secularism. They were divided about the Jewish future. Is our future there, i.e. in Palestine, or here in Poland? They were divided about language. Is our language Yiddish? Is our language Hebrew? Is it legitimate to have a Jewish culture in Polish? So it was a very fractious kind of a community. And Emanuel Ringelblum was part of a party called the Left Labor Zionists. They were very Marxist. They believed in a world revolution. You might argue they were pro-Soviet, although not a communist. And their ideological mentor was a Jewish writer named Ber Baruchov, who died in 1917, but who had developed a highly idiosyncratic and complicated idea of Jewish history in the diaspora, which basically argued that Jews ultimately cannot survive in the diaspora because anti-Semitism will render them economically superfluous. That is, that that anti-Semitism will push Jewish workers, Jewish entrepreneurs to the periphery. And therefore, Jews will have to constantly migrate, and ultimately this migration will end up in Palestine as a territorial base. It was a highly complicated ideology, but to cut to the chase, what it meant was that the adherents of this party had to study Jewish economic and social history of the 15th, 16th, 17th century to make their case that the Jews were in a constant economic struggle with their neighbors, that Jews were being constantly forced to move, that it was economic competition rather than religion, which was the reason that the Jewish nation survived. So this was an example of history very much involved, not just with scholarship, but with a political agenda.
How did, and this is something I know just a very little bit about, and I remember it primarily from graduate school, how did the left labor Zionists relate, or how would you compare them to the, I guess, much larger, stronger, and maybe even better organized Bund?
Yeah, well, the Bund, of course, was the major Jewish left-wing party in Poland. The Bund's philosophy was very, very simple. We believe, the Bund said, in democratic socialism. We believe in world revolution, but we oppose this Bolshevik idea of dictatorship. And as far as the Jewish question is concerned, the Jews in Poland will enjoy equal rights when there's a socialist revolution. And then the Jews will be able to develop their Yiddish culture and be able to remain in Poland, which is their country. The Bund rejected the idea that there was such a thing as a worldwide Jewish nation with common interests. The Bund rejected the idea that this worldwide Jewish nation needed a territorial base in Palestine, mm-hmm. in order to maintain its identity. The Bund focused on struggle here in Poland. Its motto was Dojkite, which in Yiddish means here-ness. Mm-hmm. Our home is here. Mm-hmm. And the Bund was also very optimistic about the Jewish future in Poland. It believed that ultimately the Polish left would triumph and the Jews would enjoy equal rights. Mm-hmm. Emanuel Ringelblum's left labor Zionists, unlike the Bund, really believed that the Jewish problem was worldwide, that it was existential, that that unless the Jews had a territorial base in Palestine, even if there were a socialist revolution in Poland, there would still be anti-Semitism and the Jews would still be marginalized. Mm-hmm. Indeed, the left labor Zionists pointed to the Soviet Union as an example where after the revolution of 1917, the Jews are going into white-collar occupations, they're going into managerial occupations. They still retain that different economic structure even after socialism, and that's leading to anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. So the left labor Zionists were territorialists. They believed that ultimately mm-hmm. Jews needed a territory, and once they had that territory, then it didn't matter if millions of Jews remained in the diaspora, but the territory would be the model, it would be the template mm-hmm. that would change Jewish psychology, and that would give Jews in the diaspora a clearer sense of identity and belonging.
Mm-hmm. Let me complicate the picture even further and ask how Ringelblum and the Bund, if you will, related to two other groups, that is, one unorganized, and that is Jews that were simply assimilating. Actually, I was just reading about Freud recently, who was born Shlomo Freud, if I'm not incorrect, and then yeah. according to him, modernized his name. That's the way he put it to Sigismund. And then a second group would be the Hasidim in Poland and elsewhere. These would be what we would call Orthodox Jews. What do they think about these two groups?
Well, it's very interesting that, of course, ideologically, the Bund opposed both assimilation and the Hasidim, and so did the left labor Zionists. Now, again, as far as the Bund was concerned, this was a process of evolution. When the Bund began, its attitude towards assimilation was totally neutral. If you want to assimilate, fine. At first, the Bund was not so much interested in Jewish culture as it was in mobilizing Jewish workers to fight the Tsar. But over time, the Bund evolved as a party dedicated to Yiddish and as a party that fought assimilation as a program, the same for the labor Zionists. Now, in practice, though, in the 1930s, as anti-Semitism escalates in Poland, after the death of Józef Piłsudski, the Bund organizes defense squads of tough, husky workers who defend Hasidim who are being attacked mm-hmm. in public parks. The Bund also organizes defense squads at Warsaw and Lwów and Vilna universities mm-hmm. defending middle-class Jewish students who are usually Polish-speaking and certainly not from working-class families. So on the one hand, ideologically, parties like the Bund and the left labor Zionists were opposed to the Orthodox and to the Jewish middle classes, but in the Jewish Polish-speaking assimilated middle classes. But as anti-Semitism escalates, there's the realization that we're all in the same boat. We're all Jews. We all have to defend mm-hmm. ourselves. It's a matter of national honor. Mm-hmm. And there is this real psychology of circling the wagons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that comes clear in the founding of Oinig Shabbos itself. So let's go directly to that. Now, the Germans set up the Warsaw Ghetto in the fall of 1940. Is that correct?
Yes, in November 1940.
Yeah, 1940. How did Ringelblum respond to this?
Well, at first, of course, nobody could predict that the Germans were going to progress to extermination, to a mass murder. And as I said, the Nazis themselves didn't decide this until sometime in the second half of 1941. So when the Warsaw Ghetto begins, and of course everybody was shocked to find that it would be closed off, the hope had been that, yeah, we'll live in a ghetto, but won't be allowed to leave the ghetto during the day. But when the Warsaw Ghetto was closed off, people like Emanuel Ringelblum went to the habits, went to the experience that they had before the war. That is, we Jews have to organize soup kitchens, we have to organize house committees, we have to organize self-help. Self-help is not just charity, it's not just helping the poor, but it's the basic guarantee of communities solidarity. Before the war, Ringelblum had been a community organizer. He'd organized small loan societies, what today we would call micro credit. Long before the war, Ringelblum was convinced that it wasn't so much the money that these small loan societies lent, but it was the moral message that the Jews stick together, that we're not all alone. The small loan societies were financed by the Joint Distribution Committee, an American organization, but the rule was 50-50, that 50% of the capital would come from America, but Jews would have to raise the remaining 50% themselves. All of this to replace the traditional idea of charity with the idea of Alleinhilfe, with self-help. And Ringelblum took this idea into the Warsaw Ghetto. In other words, in the initial period of the Warsaw Ghetto, he saw this as a test of the maturity of the Jewish people in Warsaw, and he believed that with a proper organization and with goodwill, the Jews would pass that test. So in the Warsaw Ghetto, you had 1,000 house committees. You had dozens of soup kitchens. You had this enormous effort to mobilize the community to help the less fortunate. And, of course, people had no idea how long the war was going to last. And they thought that if the war lasts a year or so, we'll be able to somehow survive. And in these 1,000 house committees, people in a particular building in the ghetto would make lists of their poor neighbors. They would make schedules of which family was to feed which poor child. They established daycare centers. There was this massive effort, and Emanuel Ringelblum was one of the leaders. And one of the great stories of the archive is that it traces the growing pressure on the self-help, the fact that ultimately one house committee after another begins to run out of money. It traces this battle between the Jews struggling to survive economically and the growing impoverishment, the lack of food, the lack of money, and yet, despite all of the terrible difficulties, between November 1940 and June 1942, when the extermination begins, 80% of the Warsaw Jews managed to survive. 20% die of starvation and disease, but 80% managed to survive. And one of the real stories that Emanuel Ringelblum is telling is that he's tracing this massive communal effort at organization in order not only to save people, but to maintain a sense of communal pride and basic dignity.
So on the one hand, Ringelblum and his circle are working in the in these self-help organizations. On the other hand, he's already set up Oining Shabbos, right?
Yes, and the two go hand in hand because the whole archive is embedded in the self-help organization. the self-help organization with its soup kitchens, with its house committees, with its refugee committees. This is the cover which allows the Oynik Shabbos to decide what project we're going to do, who we're going to interview. The self-help organization, especially as 100,000 refugees are shoved into the Warsaw ghetto, the self-help allows the Oynik Shabbos, say, to set up massive interview projects with the refugees to get information from what's going on outside of Warsaw. The people who are running the soup kitchen, who are also part of the Oynik Shabbos, give Emanuel Ringelblum information on individuals who know a lot, who would be useful to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the self-help, the archive is able to interview these people to organize projects without having to compromise secrecy.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about who was in the Oynik Shabbos.
Well, of the 60 or so people in the Oynik Shabbos, there was quite a diverse representation. There was a rabbi, Shimon Huberbond, who was a budding historian before the war, but also a devout Orthodox rabbi, and he was one of the major sources of information about the religious community and religious life during the war. He perished in Treblinka in 1942. But alongside Shimon Huberbaum, there was a communist. There was Yehuda Feld, who worked with children in the ghetto. There were general Zionists such as Lipa Block. There was Yitzhak Gitterman, who was the head of the Joint Distribution Committee. There were women such as Rachel Auerbach and Cecilia Slapakova, that is, women who had been active in journalism and in writing before the war. There were totally obscure figures like Daniel Fliegelman, a young man who arrives as a refugee in the Warsaw ghetto and catches the eye of some of the leaders of the Oynik Shabbos for his skill as a writer, and he's recruited to conduct interviews. So the Oynik Shabbos runs the whole gamut. There are writers who write in Yiddish. There are writers who write in Polish. Once a week, the executive committee meets on Saturday afternoons. That's one reason why you had that code name, Joy of the Sabbath, Oynik Shabbos, and they would chart the assignments. They would decide on the priorities, and they would decide who was going to do what.
Mm-hmm. How did the Oynik Shabbos relate to the Jewish authorities in the ghetto?
Well, that's an interesting question. In the Warsaw ghetto, the Oynik Shabbos really gave the Judenrat, the Jewish Council, a wide berth. They didn't trust the Jewish Council, and they were afraid compromising secrecy. In some other ghettos where there were secret archives, there was more collaboration with the Jewish Council. But in the Warsaw ghetto, Emanuel Ringelblum really tried to avoid the Jewish Council. Now, there was one exception, Shmuel Vinter, a wealthy businessman from Slavic, who, like many other members of the Oynik Shabbos, had been active in the YIVO, the Yiddish Scientific Organization, which before the war in Poland had been very much dedicated to developing scholarship in the Yiddish language. And Shmuel Vinter was wealthy. He was well known. He was recruited to a Judenrat department, but because they knew him and trusted him, he was also a key member of the Oynik Shabbos. But that was the exception that really proved the basic rule.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that comes up again and again in the book, and it's something that Ringelblum and his comrades think quite a bit about and obviously are vexed by, is the behavior of both the Judenrat and the Jewish police. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very painful and complicated subject. And And basically, in some ways, Ringelblum was unfair about some of the Judenrat leaders. Like many others, he was, I think, a little bit too judgmental about Adam Chernyakov, who was the head of the Judenrat and who took his own life in July 1942. I think there was not enough understanding of the particular position that Chernyakov was in. That said, there was in the Warsaw Ghetto a growing hatred of the Judenrat, and especially a growing hatred of the Jewish police. When the Jewish police was first formed, there was some admiration, and there was a certain tendency to welcome the Jewish police. There were no Jewish policemen before the war in Poland. We have our own Jews now keeping order. You could speak to them in Yiddish. The problem was that over time, as with so many other aspects of ghetto life, you saw a deterioration. That is, since the Jewish police were not paid, they began to take bribes. They began to single out poor people when they were told to catch people to send to labor camps. The moral level of the Jewish police constantly fell. Then, of course, when the Great Deportations began in July 1942, the Jewish police are told to catch five Jews a day to protect themselves and their families from deportation, and they turn into monsters. And the Jewish police was very hated, and the Oinikshab has documented this process.
What I'm very interested, one of the things that you do a really nice job of chronicling is the reasonably, well, I was going to say slow realization of what was going on beginning in the summer of 1942, that in fact the ghetto was basically set to be eliminated along with all the Jews in it. Could you talk about the process by which information concerning mass extermination filtered into the ghetto and how Ringelblum responded to it?
Well, that's an important question. I mean, how the Jews learned, when did they know, what did they know, how did they relate to the material? Now, the first mass killings were in Lithuania. And in October 1941, an envoy from the Vilnius ghetto reaches the Warsaw ghetto and talks about the mass killings in Vilnius and in other places. But many Warsaw Jewish leaders, including Emanuel Ringelblum, don't want to believe that this is the first step in a major German project to kill all the Jews. They see this as a local event, caused perhaps by the particular hatred that many Lithuanians felt for the Jews, caused perhaps by the fact this was had been Soviet-occupied territory. So he refused to really see this as the beginning of a major extermination program. In February 1942, an escapee from the Chelmno death camp arrives in the Warsaw Ghetto, and he is led to the Oinikshab, and he gives a thorough and detailed interview about Chelmno. And then the Oinikshab begins to understand that the Germans are intending to murder the Polish Jews. But even so, Ringelblum himself holds on to every shred of hope that he can. In June 1942, when the BBC makes a broadcast using Einik Shabbos material, Emanuel Ringelblum says, well, now that the German people know what's going on, they'll force Hitler to stop. People who used to vote for the communists and the SPD won't allow such a crime to be committed in their name. When the Warsaw Ghetto extermination begins in the summer of 1942, he's still hoping that maybe part of the ghetto will be maintained as a labor reserve. So it's only gradually that Ringelblum begins to understand what's at stake. And this is a very well-informed historian. He has access to all this information, but even he has trouble grasping the full enormity of what's going on until well into 1942.
Mm-hmm. As well he might. It seems to me he goes through kind of a tripartite progression. At first, you know, his notion is that the Oining Shabbos is going to help save the Jewish people after the war. Then in this second phase that begins in the summer of 1942, after it's clear that the Germans are bent on extermination, he begins to think about saving the Polish intelligentsia. And then in the third, he's saving himself.
The Jewish intelligentsia.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about that second stage, because he does kind of shift his goal a little bit at that point.
Well, at first, of course, he's hoping for a usable past. He's hoping that most Jews will survive. When it becomes clear after the summer of 1942 that a very few Jews will survive, he's still hoping that money that's available might be used to save a core of the Jewish intellectual elite, the writers, people who might be able to rebuild Jewish culture after the war. This runs into many difficulties, and he doesn't get much support from others for this idea.
And then at a certain point, there's a kind of, I don't know if there's a division within the Oinig Shabbos, but there is a division within the Jewish intelligentsia in the Warsaw, and many of them go over to the so-called Aryan side. I have a couple of questions about this. I wasn't aware that the boundary was very porous, that it was very easy to go to the Aryan side. I wasn't also aware that there were a lot of sympathizers on the Aryan side to the Jewish cause. Maybe you could talk about both of those issues.
Well, it wasn't so easy to go to the Aryan side, because to survive on the Aryan side, you needed impeccable command of Polish, but not too good a command of Polish, because that wasn't natural either. You needed iron nerves. You needed papers. You needed a lot of contacts, and in fact, many Jews who were hiding on the Aryan side returned to the ghetto. But after the fall of 1942, it became clear that there was simply no choice, that no matter how difficult it was on the Aryan side, it was the only hope of surviving the war. And then more and more people began to go to the Aryan side. Ringelblum himself sent his wife and child to the Aryan side in February 1943, and then he went himself to this hideout. But at the same time, he would come back into the ghetto very often to continue to do his work there. And he was indeed caught in the ghetto when the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising started. But he was heavily criticized by some of his associates for going to the Aryan side instead of staying in the ghetto. And of course, this exposed what Professor Lawrence Lager has called the world of choiceless choices. That is, that no matter what you did, there was simply no good choice. To save himself, he had to neglect the work in the archive. He was criticized for that. And so he tried to compromise. He would stay with his wife and child on the Aryan side. He'd come back into the ghetto. That resulted in his being caught and sent to the Trebniki labor camp.
How did the Polish resistance relate to the news, really, in the summer of 1942 that the Jews were going to be exterminated?
Well, the Polish resistance was, of course, very heterogeneous. It was very diverse. There were basically the Polish underground army saw the Jews as foreigners, not as Poles, not as people within the sphere of Polish moral responsibility. So what's happening to the Jews is one thing, but they're not Poles. We have our own agenda, our own timetable. There were many members of the Polish underground who were very happy that the Germans were solving Poland's Jewish problem. On the other hand, the head of the propaganda division of the Polish Home Army was very sympathetic to the Jews, and the Journal of the Polish Home Army began to report on the tragedy of the Jews in greater detail in late 1942. Some Polish intellectuals in late 1942 founded a group called Żegota, the Council to Aid Jews. Emanuel Ringelblum believed that while this was a laudable effort, it was too little and too late. Basically, Ringelblum was extremely critical of how Poles helped or didn't help Jews, although he was quick to stress that many Poles did help Jews at the cost, at the risk of their lives, and that he himself was being helped by Poles, and indeed the Poles who built the hideout, which hid 37 Jews, and which was ultimately discovered by the Gestapo. Two of those Poles were executed along with the Jews.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the burial of the archive itself. When was it decided to bury it?
Well, the first cache of the archive with tin boxes covering the material from 1940 to August 1942. That cache was buried on August 3rd, 1942. And it was buried under the former school of the labor Zionists. And at that point, nobody knew who was going to survive the summer of deportations. The archive continued working after the first cache was buried, and the second cache was buried in two aluminum milk cans in February 1943. Mm-hmm. And then a third cache was buried under the brushmaker's factory on Świętajerska 34. That was buried just a couple days before the outbreak of the ghetto revolt. In September 1946, the searchers found the tin boxes of the first cache, although Hirschwasser, Ringelblum's secretary and the one who knew where the archive was buried, said that much material was actually missing and a lot of water had seeped in and many of the documents were damaged. They kept looking, couldn't find anything else. And then in December 1950, Polish construction workers found the two milk cans of the second cache, and there the documents were much better protected. Mm. Świętajerska 34, where the third cache was buried, became the site of the Chinese embassy in Poland. And a few years ago, Israeli searchers got permission from the Chinese to look underneath their embassy, but they couldn't find anything. Mm. So basically, two of the three caches were found, and we have about 25,000 to 30,000 documents.
Mm-hmm. And where are those documents today?
The originals are in Warsaw, Poland, and there are microfilm copies at Yad Vashem in Israel and at the U.S. Holocaust Museum.
What did Ringelblum want to happen to them? Didn't he have some specific plans about...
Well, they believed that if after the war, if they were found, they should be sent to the YIVO in New York, the Yiddish Scientific Institute, which had moved its base to New York in 1940.
I was going to say, I have to ask, why wasn't that wish honored?
post-war Poland was a communist country. It was the Cold War. Jewish survivors had founded a Jewish Historical Institute in Poland, which is still working and which is still doing wonderful work. And it would simply have been politically inopportune to send this archive to imperialist U.S. At a time when Poland was an ally of the Soviet Union. And I think many of the Jewish scholars were still hoping that Poland would maintain some degree of intellectual freedom and give Jews some chance to rebuild a life after the war. So there was a short time after the war where there was a hope that there might be a revival of real Jewish life and Jewish scholarship.
How much of the Oneg Shavos archive has been published?
Not much. You've had four volumes of documents published in Poland. You had about a 700-page English collection translated into English, published in the 1980s, but most of the archive has not been published.
And has it been extensively studied? Has the entire archive been gone through?
Not really. Now, the director of the Jewish Historical Institute, Dr. Lena Bergman in Poland, is now trying to set up a project that is going to systematically publish the entire archive.
Yeah, that's an excellent idea. I hope that he does it on the internet so that we can all look at it, and in multiple languages so that we can all read it. What would you say? We've taken up a lot of your time, I know. Let me ask you a couple of final questions. One is, what do you think that the this is sort of a broad question. Historians don't like this kind of thing, but what do you think the legacy of Oneg Shavos is and Ringelblum?
I think the legacy is that in times of a disaster, one can resist not only with guns but with paper and pen. That Ringelblum and many of the Jews understood that the Germans were sure they would win the war, that they would determine how the Jews would be remembered, that they would control the sources, they would control the memory, they would control the image. And Jews in the ghettos, historians in the ghettos, even if they understood that they probably would not survive, still believed it was important to leave time capsules, to leave sources, so that posterity would remember Polish Jewry, its final chapter, on the basis of Jewish sources, Jewish documents. The real message is that history is important. It's important to conserve documents. It's important to conserve a record. It's not just for antiquarians. It's not just for librarians, but it's really about the future of an entire people. And on a more general level, it instills a healthy respect for preserving a sense of the past.
No, I could not have said it better. The most incredible thing about this story to me is the fact that even while they were facing death, Ringelblum and his comrades continued to do this work. Literally almost to the day that he died, or maybe even on the day that he died, he was doing this work. He felt it was that important. And, you know, I have to say that he was right about that, because we are on the phone talking about him, not about the people who murdered him. So if he's up in heaven, I will tip my hat to him, and also I'll tip my hat to you. Let me ask one final question. What are you working on now? What's your next project, Sam?
Well, I'm working on a museum of Polish Jewish history that's going to be opened in Warsaw, Poland in 2011.
That's terrific.
Helping to design some pavilions. And I have a longer-term project to write a history of Polish Jews in the interwar period.
That's a terrific project, because I think it's very much misunderstood. I mean, the extent to which that we tend to cast back from the Holocaust to the interwar period, I think sort of blinds us to the incredible diversity of Jewish life. I mean, as a Russian historian myself, I know about the incredible sort of diversity of it in the 19th and 20th century. But I think in the Polish perspective, it tends to be overshadowed by what happens later on. And that's a terrific project. And you have to promise to, when you're done with that, come back on the show and talk to us.
Okay.
Well, Sam, thank you very much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Okay, take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Sam Kassow, author of Who Will Write Our History? Emanuel Ringelblum, The Warsaw Ghetto, and the Oydig Shabbos Archive. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. Hope you have a great week.